The Eve book is all about how we're starting to rethink what female mammals' evolution was really like and how that does and doesn't intersect with how we live in these bodies now.
Hello, I'm Adrian Dobb.
I'm Laura Good.
And this is The Feminist Present, the podcast that uses the gift of feminism to figure out what's going on right now.
We need some feminism to figure out what's going on right now, because I don't know if either of us know.
Yeah.
We're both looking a little
dazed.
What is going on? It is 2025, Adrian, and it's been kind of a lot.
You guys.
Holy balls.
It's been crazy.
Whew.
I don't know if you heard.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys have heard. Yeah. It's been a little
We know you guys aren't sort of into the whole politics thing, but we, on the other hand, have really been keeping our we've been keeping our fingers to the wind, and boy.
The farts in the wind are strong, and they seem to be coming from Washington. And it's not been the chillest time I've ever experienced in higher education, and I don't know if I've experienced a chill time in higher education yet. Is it my fault that the pandemic and all of this happened? Because I started at Stanford in 2019, and it was pretty chill for like 2 minutes.
You're the albatross. You just...
God damn, I'm so sorry, everybody.
The entire ship was going great.
I apologize.
People were,
funding
the humanities like crazy. Our graduate students were all getting jobs. And then Laura shows up and is like, hey, what's going on over here? And we're like, oh no, it's the cooler.
Hey, my kids wanted health insurance. Oh, I've missed you. It's been too long since we've been on this Zoom, not even a Zoom line anymore. We started in the Zoom era in 2020, and that was 500 years ago. And that is the perfect on-ramp to talking about a book that covers 200 million years of evolution.
Yeah, in our defense, we had to read a 600-page book that covers 200 million years. So that's what we've been doing.
And we have humanities degrees. Yes, exactly. We are talking to the very brilliant Kat Bohannon today about this book, Eve. And Kat has such a fascinating background. We'll get into this in the interview, but she has more degrees than a goddamn hot oven. And they're all in different things, and yet they all interrelate in this story about evolution, which I thought was just fascinating.
And I mean, Eve has been out since 2023, so it's quite possible that some of our readers have already encountered it or have read reviews. To say very little about it until we drew out very nicely in the conversation what this book is and how it argues, but I would say it's kind of creative nonfiction on evolution, right? Does that seem fair?
Yes.
Which is such an interesting, it's science explanation with a deliberately speculative streak, and with a real eye to the risks that come with that kind of speculation, right? So you get both. You get sort of like, what if this is how we got menopause? But also, here are the risks of speculating why we got menopause. I think it's interesting if you are interested in this topic, which I'm guessing most of our listeners will be, but it's also fascinating for how we can know, how we can argue, and how we can contest scientific claims in this age, right? How to have fun with science without either kind of taking it as kind of an almost metaphysical kind of guarantee, like now we know the truth, or go all relativist and say like, we can't really know.
Yeah. I mean, Kat is speaking so informedly into the void of how the female body has been excluded from scientific research, among other things. And one of the things that I kept thinking about constantly as I was reading it and connecting those dots was how much that comes up for the pregnant body. You know, I remember when I was pregnant, being really frustrated with being told a standard amount of weight to gain for any body. And I think it was like 25 to 30 pounds. And I did some research on this and found out that all of those technologies were modeled on a quote unquote default male body for pregnancy. And so I think she's speaking into a really important gap of why women are so underserved by the medical establishment and to a certain degree by the scientific establishment. And I think even though like my graduate degree is in poetry, I find that deeply compelling and important and discussable. And I also think a theme of the feminist present and the books that we choose is we choose really nerdy books that are actually really readable and like really approachable. And I think this book fits very neatly into that category. Deeply nerdy, but like very page turning. Yeah. Also,
I think it's if people again haven't encountered it, definite recommendation. And yeah, it's a thing that we haven't really covered on the pod that much, which is sort of science writing, but with a really interesting twist, which is sort of what you've come to expect from the feminist present.
It's our brand. Oh my God, I have to tell you a horrifying thing that my kid said the other day, breaking my usual embargo on quoting my kids. The younger one did something very sweet for the older one. I don't even remember what it was. I just remember saying like, oh, that was a really nice brother move. Like, thank you for doing that. That was really sweet to help out your brother. Younger son goes, yeah, that's pretty much my brand.
Oh man.
I was like, you have a brand? You're seven. Like, but he does.
No,
I
gotta have a brand.
That's kind of the kid he is. Gotta have a brand. I mean, little San Francisco children in 2025, they have it whether we like it or not.
Our babysitter is the president of her babysitting co-op.
That's a brand.
That's a brand.
That's absolutely
a brand. They have a website and everything.
Well, to our listeners, you can expect some other interviews upcoming. Although we've been a little quiet in 2025 so far, we have some really exciting stuff coming up on the schedule. So we hope you will stay tuned in for us to speak to other nerds about nerdy subjects that are deeply gripping and approachable.
And for now, enjoy our conversation with Kat Bohannon.
Kat Bohannon, welcome to The Feminist Present. We're so delighted to have you here. Thank you for making the time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Speaking of time, you covered 260 million years in this book, and I imagine that was a challenge.
Well, formally, it was only like 200 million, according to the title. And I just did a little toe back. It was just, it's a reasonable amount of time.
Totally reasonable.
Totally unambitious topic.
Yes.
I know.
Yes.
Obviously, I'm very healed mentally and otherwise. I mean, the thing about our bodies is they are themselves units of time, effectively, right? There is not simply the arbitrariness of what is a lifespan. It's what is a species? What are these events unfolding over time? And so if you want to then say, what is the evolution of the average female along this accidental path? Well, then you have to actually weirdly go back 200 million years. Maybe actually you have to go back a few billion, but I cut myself off.
Yes, yes. Very reasonable.
I also feel like the book has a... It's about the dangers of storytelling over these kinds of distances. And yet, what I really liked about it was that you went there. You did engage in storytelling about these vast oceans of time. What were your kind of ground rules in doing that and being a little speculative and telling these really gigantic stories? Did you put kind of very clear boundaries on your own ambitions, or did you say, hey, I'm just going to let it ride?
Well, there are different sorts of storytelling here. I mean, there is the storytelling, which is what are the current modes of thought and how have they changed around these kinds of evolutionary moves. That's the science story. And then there's the deep aesthetic thing that happens when you describe events over time, right? Which is the art making, which is something I also know a strangely large amount about because of my PhD, where I then have these little vignettes or these little narrative moments, these little deeply imagistic moments where I drop you in time, right? Where you might meet one of the Eves, one of the last common ancestors of a trait, and I kind of see what it's like to try and do perspective work there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there are two things I was doing there. I mean, one is... you know, it's a way of getting inside all of the research that I had done on each of the Eves, you know, to sort of formulate my own orientation towards them or understanding of them, not to humanize them, but just to make some of it comprehensible in a way, even for myself and then for my reader, that it wouldn't otherwise be, right? But it was also like, I like hard problems. And it's technically impossible to actually imagine what it would be like to be Morgie. It's actually wildly impossible, not just in that, you know, Nagel, what's it like to be a bat kind of way. I mean, it's actually just straight impossible with this brain to imagine the sensory experience, much less selfhood of a creature 200 million years ago. But I liked that it was a knotty problem, you know, both as a scientist and an artist. I liked being inside that asymptotic thing where you can get close, but you can't quite. Mm-hmm. So I also just found it stimulating to try.
Yeah, I feel like I want to narrate here for people who haven't read the book that Kat, I mean, you say it's not humanizing, but there is quite a bit of personification and sort of characterization going on of the Morgi was 205 million years ago. Donna was 67 million years ago and sort of taking us through these phases of history through these personified Eves, which I thought was just a really brilliant narrative device that suggested you had some experience in writing. So that's where I want to go before we get hard into the book. So Kat, you have a really interesting educational background. Could you give us a walking tour of that educational background?
That little freak ball journey? Sure. Well, I mean, so there's formal education and then there's lived life. I was born in Atlanta because my dad was a research psychologist, ran a lab down at Emory. They were from New York, but I was whelped there. And that is how I came into, you know, growing up through childhood. So I was, you know, I was a subject before I was a researcher, and I'm fine. I have a great therapist. But I, you know, I spent my puberty helping prep his slides and things like that. So I had this weird, you know, insider zone in psychology throughout my childhood. So then by the time I'm in university and I've started writing poems, my mother was a pianist, I was like, yeah, I'm good with science for a hot minute. I'm gonna go be a poet for a while, do an MFA in poetry. I'm gonna do that. Of course, a lot of my verse was about scientific concepts, but you know, I always kind of did both. And then I just got the research itch, and then I went back for the PhD. And I did this really interdisciplinary thing at Columbia, where I did my PhD in narrative and cognition. I was really, really interested in the deep mechanics of what we call aesthetic experience. I was really interested in what the brain might be doing there and how that might loop around and produce certain kinds of art and if there might be a way to quantify that. So I wrote a whole bunch of computer programs and I basically asked cognitive questions of narratives over the last 400 years in the English language, which means that I now know, that may sound like a whole nothing burger. Let me better explain. I know the linguistic footprint of sex scenes in the English language for about four centuries, which is not actually content and is based on parts of speech. There's a distinctive parts of speech signal for sex scenes, which I'm now the world's expert on. So that's really useful.
What is the parts of speech signal? That's fascinating.
Well, one of the obvious ones is that proper nouns go down. So proper nouns are what? You know, they're the names of people and places and things. So unless you're describing an orgy in a transparent bus driving past the Eiffel Tower, you're not going to have a lot of proper nouns in a sex scene in English for the last 400 years. But what was more interesting for me cognitively, that's just more like a fun thing you say over drinks, right? Is that information density goes up. So what that means is the way I quantified it was how many modifiers, you know, you get a real shift in the signal of adjectives and adverbs and descriptor language. When you do an analysis of actual words, you'll certainly get a lot more sensory description happening. But you can even get it all the way down into simply how dense is the information signal in this moment, which actually is really closely aligned to how we organize long-term memory.
That is so interesting.
Right. So if you have particular kinds of emotional memory in psych, we do know that your long-term capture of sensory detail tends to go way up. Say you've been in a car crash or you've had a first kiss with someone you actually like. It turns out to be different if you didn't really like them. Anyway, you know, that if you that memory is strongly modulated by emotional signal in the moment of encounter, in the moment of encoding. And then weirdly, our encounter then, if we were to like tell the story, as it were, of our own lives, would have this kind of string of pearls feature, right? Like time slowing down, a whole lot of information, very dense, and then a skinny string of, I don't know, something happened, whatever, lunch on Tuesday, fine. And then another big dense moment. And you can actually see that similar structure in long form narrative, which is probably not at all what you thought I would be talking to you about in this moment about this book, but that was my PhD.
Well, but it's fascinating and kind of revealing, because as we're talking about narrative, memory, speech, scene, I think you skipped a degree in the education history you were giving us, because between the MFA in poetry and the PhD, didn't you actually get an MFA in creative nonfiction?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry.
Which is very related to these subjects.
I totally did. I totally did, which was stimulating. And I did that because I was a poet in residence in Dalian, China at Dr. Günter von Hagen's Body Worlds Factory for a couple weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Back in 2000, it was before Body Worlds had toured in the US, actually. But after von Hagen's had been kicked out of Germany for body trafficking. anyway, so he moved to this totally reasonable place for someone accused of that to go, which is Dalian, China. Fine. All of that, fine. Probably not fine.
Fine.
So I was really fascinated by this Warhol-like factory, and I was like, I'm going to go cook up a gig. I'm going to go be there for a couple of weeks and surrounded by buckets of people and see what kind of art they're actually making, because they are making art, weirdly. And what does that involve, besides all the ethics of it? Which is
significant, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I got back from that in whatever that was that 2004, 2003? I don't know, something like that. And I just couldn't, I could not poem. I was supposed to write a poem cycle, and my stanzas just could not stanza. I just, yeah. And it took me about a year, and I wrote this very lyric essay about it all and published that, and then sort of moved on. And that was how I started writing prose at all. And that's actually how my agent found me too.
That just seems like such an interesting bridge between the poetry and the cognition, and it feels all very related to me.
It all, in back, in hindsight, yes. It all totally makes sense. At the time, yes. It was just a chick in her 20s. But yeah.
Relatable. Adrian, let me let you get a word in edgewise here.
Well, I wanted to ask about this question. I mean, I'm still very fascinated with the sex scenes and wondering about it is also this kind of this question of what kind of a vocabulary we arrive at to discuss and to describe our own bodies, right? So you've been on this trajectory for decades, it seems to me. And again, I'm wondering, in telling this story, how much poetry did you want to allow yourself? Like is that how you thought of it? Or was it like always going to be sort of a middle path no matter what you did?
You know, I find it so interesting. I was going to say telling, but the way we're returning to this idea of permitting art, right?
Yeah.
You know, that we allow ourselves to write in a certain way. And I think the main reason that's coming up is, one, that it's under a genre of nonfiction, so the ethics of truth telling, but it's also specifically about science.
That's right.
You know,
and biological science, I think.
Mm-hmm, very much so. There are a few other sciences involved in there, but mostly bio.
As I was thinking about the contrast to physics. Physicists always get to speculate and write sci-fi and no one says boo, but there's something about our bodies that I think where myth-making is sort of like verboten.
Well, depending which physicist you ask, I mean, is string theory a novel or not? There is quite a lot of philosophy, depending what sort of physicist you might be. Anyway, we'll set that aside. It's maybe a cheap joke. I have many friends who are physicists, and I admire their work. Anyway, I think that's interesting, right? There is this kind of tension around how much of an aesthetic you can build. But you're right, maybe especially around biology. When you're writing about science, and you're writing it in a way where you anticipate that your readers, listeners, audience members are themselves maybe not scientists, right? And I think that you're right that there's a tension, there's a sense of the ethics of it, you know, are we breaking a rule when we do one thing or another, and the speculation, non-speculation. I think part of it too is, especially now, the NIH is on fire, especially now in this real garbage fire that we're in as a country around truth versus truthiness, around the public's relation to the sciences, this invented idea of a public, but you know what I mean, you know, that maybe it feels more fraught even. What are we allowed? What is permissible? So I don't think I had the axe over my head the whole time when I was letting myself write. But I did find that also aesthetically, it works so much better to let yourself have some free rein when you're talking about things in the far distant past as opposed to recent. For example, it comes off as the worst sort of genre fiction, and I like a lot of genre fiction, so I mean that as the worst sort, when you try to imagine the inner life of a human ancestor 10,000 years ago. And that was something my editor and I struggled with in some of the later Eves, you know, that there was this thing where, like, how much of her inner world can we imagine before it feels just badly done?
Yeah.
Which I think it was interesting to me on many levels to arrive at that conclusion, that actually we're much more willing to go into a weird alien dive into the alien mind of a thing like Morgana Cadon, you know, than we are in a human or near human ancestor.
Well, okay. So especially since this book seems so indescribable, and also because
does it? Oh no!
Well, just because you're
it's
covering
been on the
so much
bestseller list for 3 weeks in a row now.
I'm not saying it's unintelligible. I'm saying it's ambitious, and I know that this book has been out for about a year and a half, and I know how authors talking about books work. So I imagine you have a better grasp on, like, your elevator pitch for this book at this point. So how would you describe this incredibly ambitious book?
The Eve book is all about how we're starting to rethink what female mammals' evolution was really like and how that does and doesn't intersect with how we live in these bodies now, you know? Yeah. It's really a deep dive into many different fields of science and knowledge production, trying to wrestle with it all to say, okay, who do I have to blame for my period? You know, because there's somebody and I'm mad, you know, that there's, and of course the somebody is actually this like weasel chick living in trees, but we can hold her accountable. I think it's science heavy, but I write it in a way that you do not have to have any sort of PhD to understand.
I agree.
And that was important to me on many levels. And also at some point when you have a giant topic, it's really, you're going to do a better job just being as much of yourself as you can on the page.
Well, since you brought up periods, I really want to talk about menopause's role in this book, because I think some of the most sort of bomb-dropping conclusions that you dropped seem to have to do with menopause. So let me just put it to you this way. What is the evolutionary purpose of menopause, and why do humans have it?
Interesting. Okay. So yeah, so this whole idea of purpose. So in biology, this is going to be the idea of what is adaptive or not. What actually helps you better survive and thrive over deep time, over literal generations, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to want to tease out this idea of purpose, which we often weaponize from just like the weird ass accident of what helped these genes get passed on. Okay. One of the big arguments around human beings having menopause is something called the grandmother hypothesis. And it runs like this. It's actually really weird that we spend a full third of our potential lifespans, we with ovaries, having the ovaries no longer doing the thing, that we stop producing eggs that could become, future humans, and we just kind of shut all that down, right? But somehow, not yet dead. Somehow continuing to live. Actually, mm-hmm. The story of menopause has always been a story of not yet being dead. Congratulations, lady. That's what it's about. And so very few animals do this. Not just mammals. Very few animals will cease making future generations so far ahead of when they normally could or would kick the bucket, right? It actually seems to be pretty much us and a few species of toothed whale. Toothed whale. Huh. Yeah. Which we've only recently learned because it's really hard to study things that live in deep water we don't breed that, and we're not whales. So we've now learned quite a bit about killer whales, and of the ones that do have menopause like us, they are matriarchal and transient orca pods. And so it's like, okay, well, how do they go about the menopause thing? Because the grandmother hypothesis in human is like this. Well, maybe it's better to stop making babies when your babies are so stupid and can't even hold up their own heads for so long, right? Which is to say very needy. So if you don't have to take care of some of these needy babies of your own, maybe you can help out with your daughters, right? It's sort of like the science-y way of having free childcare, mm-hmm. right? Which, you know, respect, obviously. The central problem with this is like, well, did we evolve to stop making babies or was it something else? In the killer whales, we can say that they are not giving extra special attention to the skip generation. They're not helping out with the grandkids a whole lot. They're not feeding them more, protecting them more, any of that kind of stuff. Where these menopausal, matriarchal figures, who are the leaders in the group, come into play is when the local food supply runs out. They are the ones who lead them to rarer, good sources of food. They remember where to go and what to do. They're also really instrumental in teaching younger generations specialized hunting methods, which is to say what's great about older members of interdependent social groups is what they know. That's the point. That's the point. That's what they're for. And it seemed to me a much better argument for the evolution of menopause in human beings, that actually we're highly interdependent and we always have been. And it is already then valuable to have older members still be alive who can remember how to survive that sort of random spree of death that only comes on every other generation, right? How do you survive this flood? How do you survive this food problem? How do you survive that particular kind of jaguar, right? So in that case, I thought that that was precisely what menopause might be in human beings. Our bodies evolved ways of living longer. We live way longer than a chimp. We live way longer than other creatures with bodies like ours. And our ovaries maybe just never got the message, you know? It was just really useful to have older members for what they know, and they're still running the old monkey plan down in our pelvis.
Yes, exactly. I can't think of a better way to put it than that, yes.
I also wanted to ask you about sort of, there are a bunch of places in the book where we've been asking sort of about purposes and where you kind of move away from the language of purpose. And you just did it again. You kind of said like there are parts of this clearly were selected for and other parts of it, our bodies just didn't get the message. And I really like that. It's not sort of a teleological story, which you so often get and which so often sort of trends, I think, gender conservative in the sense that like, this is how we're supposed to be. And the book never says this is how we're supposed to be, or not very frequently, and says, but this is how things wound up the way they did, probably, or possibly, or plausibly. And I guess I was thinking specifically about the question of sex roles in general, where you sort of say, you kind of split the difference. You say, we are probably evolutionarily predisposed to have them, but not the ones that we have. Is that right? Which I thought was very elegant. But it is also this kind of nice meta move where you sort of say like, look, yes, in a distributive kind of small community, it makes sense to not have everyone do the same thing. But it doesn't say anything or doesn't really teach us anything about who should be going to Costco right now.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's this... I don't know if I'm exactly splitting the difference, but maybe. I think that given that human reproduction is so costly, and we've spent so much time in this fetocentric kind of story, where it's all about how costly it is to raise babies, that the babies are so vulnerable, and given so little attention to the physical costs and social costs, but especially physical costs of the birthing body, you know, that actually, and not simply the moment of birth and not simply the postpartum, but actually that whole pregnancy before. And like any caretaker of bodies like these will tell you in the medical field, also your whole reproductive life before then, even before you get knocked up. And hopefully that was a choice too, right? That health trajectory so deeply shapes the likelihood of survival. And certainly the likelihood of ongoing health, however you want to model that. And that would have been so much more true in our ancestral past, even more true then that I wanted to say, okay, well then where can we see those costs playing out, right? And I think, and I did in that last chapter of the book, as you're mentioning, try and see how that might have impacted how so many human cultures have these what I call sex rules, which are deeply about controlling access to female bodies, right? Controlling how much of those bodies can be seen and where and by whom and in what context and so on and so forth, right? That maybe we don't have. I think human beings in general are culture makers and deep cultural innovators. We've probably in our 300,000 year history tried on just about every type of gender arrangement and sex arrangement. And no, I don't think intersex would have been all of that rare. And there would have been many different cultural ways of understanding it, most of which we have no access to. What we think of as the deep past is so recent in human history. You know, what the hell did we feel and think in the Paleolithic? Great question. No clue. Sometimes seems to be something about a bull. Like, we don't have that, right? And so I think what we do seem to have, though, is we keep coming up with rules, like you say, and like I said in the last chapter, around that as a subset of rules which control gender roles, sometimes sex roles in those cultures, a subset of which specifically have to do with controlling access to female bodies. And then any biologist says, okay, that's about controlling female fertility. That's about controlling when and how and where the babies get made and who gets to do it and who helps with it and who doesn't and so on and so forth. Right. And so I think we may have a natural inclination to create the rules, but what those rules would be and how we intervene on fertility is just a totally open field, with the ultimate goal ancestrally, hopefully, who knows, of keeping more people in that community alive over time. You know, but gynecology is just so much better at that now and sexism broadly is just so good at killing so many people of all genders. So I think it's time to make some choices there.
Yeah.
Hard to disagree with that. What, I mean, I'm just picturing you deep in this library for years. I mean, there's like 100 pages of footnotes in here and citations. So I can only imagine how deep and immersive the research process was. But was there anything that really jumped out and surprised you? Like, what was the biggest surprise that came up throughout this research and processing it?
I mean, there were some things that were surprising because I was in just a totally new field. You know, in cognition, I was like, all right, okay, I've sort of got my sea legs here, you know. But in deep biochem, I'm like, all right, yeah. I was a mathlete for the donuts mostly. Where am I? You know, yep. But I could dig in. It was all right. I think one of the things that really didn't surprise me was how stupidly difficult it is for human beings to make babies. I had an intuitive sense, and I'd certainly tried it, but when I actually got into the numbers and started doing comparative stuff with other primates and just other mammals in general, I was like, oh, wow. Okay. No, this is hard for us. That doesn't mean pregnancy is a disease. That doesn't mean that we need to have every moment be a medical moment, but it is legit hard just in this kind of body plan. So that was affirming. What was surprising to me is that a full third of the solid components of human milk are not digestible by human bodies. That was some cray cray. That was crazy to me that so much of lactation has to do with microbiome engineering. You know, which is this whole concept that actually when you as a person reproduce, you are not just reproducing you. You're reproducing a whole set of environments for the things that live on and in you. And that's actually deeply wound into the warp and weft of our reproductive system. That was intense and fun for me. Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah.
Just to sort of put a bow on this, like the fact that this is a story of collectivities around our bodies, including within our own bodies. And the thing it always seems to oppose is the sort of like lone caveman kind of narrative. And seems to contain a bit of a theory too as to why people gravitated to that story for so long, which was that, you know, it was a male dominated field.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm trying to move away from asking purpose oriented questions. And I really like, because that's, I can see why that's important to the argument here. But I'm really curious about how you grouped these chapters into the, like, these grand sweeping sort of flourishes of data. And you end with love. So without asking about the purpose, what is the evolutionary position of love?
You can totally ask, what's the point of love? I mean, it depends how you feel about your own love life right now. That's all right. It's legitimate. Or our own. No, sorry, I shouldn't only make jokes. Yes. I mean, I as I set up in the frame of that chapter, you know, as I was working on this book, which, you know, just logistically was very much me being a kind of cave troll, just trawling through the scientific databases in the literature, one review paper after another, and then deep dives where, you know, it deserved it. And, you know, over the course of a decade while I'm doing the PhD in parallel, I think the one of the biggest questions that kept coming up, not only in the literature, but of course, then people finding out what I was working on is, how did we go about loving each other? And usually what they really mean is, how did we go about having these cultural frames that were reinforced for our sexing, you know, and then the baby making, right? And that's what people really, really want to know. Because, of course, this whole idea of what is natural is immediately weaponized. I don't have to say that to you in this particular podcast, right?
No, indeed.
Yeah. So that meant that, you know, I knew that they were loaded questions, even the good actors who are asking them, you know what I mean? I always begin with that first principle of, we don't really know what the quote norm for human cultures would have been over 300,000 years. We don't have access to human deep past, so we can't really make claims for how we always did stuff. However, if you're looking at evolutionary things when it comes to mating patterns, right? We have studied a bunch of primates, some of whom are very like us genetically, body plan wise, even some of our sort of behavioral norms, certainly in intelligence, very similar. So I was like, okay, well, what do certain mating patterns do to a body in deep time? And is there a way we can look to that for potential evidence of our mating patterns over time? You know, can we learn anything about whether or not there were matriarchies or patriarchies, or some new understanding of what that might even mean in terms of power distribution in a group? Are there ways that we can think about sexual coercion in looking at our bodies? You know, are there ways of thinking about all this stuff? And so I did the anatomy tour, and I talked a lot about penises, because at some point you have to, believe it or not, in a book like this, you really do, because they co-evolve with the vaginal sinus. That's just how it works in any species that has them. So we get a lot of dong in chapter 10, I think it is, in the love chapter. And I just found a lot of evidence for promiscuity, actually. I didn't find a lot of evidence for harem-based societies with males at the head. I did not see that in what our body plans look like versus what you would expect in creatures like us, if that were a thing. And I also didn't see what I could find that might be a physiological bit of evidence for a lot of sexual coercion. I didn't see our body's evolutionary history is something that shows a whole lot of rape. Not to the degree that our bodies would evolve counterploys, as it were, in the female body. I did not see that. So in the last chapter, I dig into that because it seemed like an important thing to do on a few levels.
I love it. I mean, setting aside coercion, I love it when science makes an argument for promiscuity. I mean, that just brings me joy and delight, honestly.
And by definition, what you're saying about, really.
Right? Yeah. Yes, exactly. But that's interesting to study sexual coercion from the point of view of, did our bodies evolve to adapt to this? Like, that's a really specific vantage point. It's really interesting.
Well, I think it's, you know, and sometimes you even get it from scientists and then we're all just sadder. This idea that somehow being male means being sexually aggressive, that is an innate feature of maleness in mammals. And that is not the story that any good comparative ethologist in biology actually finds, you know, but it's also not something that you would see in our anatomy either. We don't have this deep story of really rapey ancestors. That doesn't mean horrors didn't happen and don't happen now. It doesn't discount the suffering that many have endured and ancestrally may well have endured. It's just that it wasn't such the norm. I really wanted to pick that lock of what normal means in when we look at the body and what can be learned or can't be learned, and does that or does that not align with these very often sexist stories we tell ourselves about what humanity naturally should be. So that was part of that intellectual work in that chapter.
Fascinating. Can I ask, so the book's been out since 2023. So I guess it's maybe time to ask an author, like, what's the reception been like? What are the questions you keep getting where you're like, huh? What are the ones that you thought you'd get and you never got? What's it been like?
I mean, for me personally, it's obviously been radically life-changing. I got to be on The Daily Show. That was fun. I don't have any background in comedy or theater or any of that. So that was intimidating and amazing. So, but in terms of what I thought from critics or from readers or that kind of response, fellow, you know, researchers, feminist scholars, I found a really wonderfully warm and receptive audience in many different spaces. And I didn't know if I would, not only because of my own insecurity of like, oh God, did I get everything wrong? It's my first book, you know? But also just, you know, am I allowed to be here in this room? You know, this isn't my specific PhD, you know, all of that. I did get some pushback in the UK from, what do they call themselves? Gender critical folk?
Gender critical.
That's right.
Feminists with scare quotes that the listener can't see me making. Yes.
You know, I mean, man, we're in a moment historically, ain't we? It's like this. I mean, I think there are lots of folk who are genuinely curious and are approaching with curiosity and don't have words to describe their curiosity. And some of them call themselves gender critical, and there has to be welcoming zones for that, because actually to get through this moment, we need everybody at the table. So here we are. Right. And then there are some less good actors in that space, let's say. And, you know, those are just challenging conversations. I try to approach it knowing that they too feel challenged. So I just try to get somewhere and then I spend my energy elsewhere. How's that?
Generous.
Look, man, I've been an activist and an advocate since the freaking 90s. I launched into puberty, came out of the closet, and immediately started organizing AIDS marches. Like, that's just like that's my zone, you know? And that's just been part of my understanding of what I'm supposed to do with my time. And so this idea that somehow I would stop being that in this role as an author writing about science would be... It just doesn't jive with me. You know what I mean?
No.
You know, and we worked very, very hard to rehome kids in the 90s who'd been kicked out by parents who didn't get it. Some of whom were trans. Some of whom were many of whom were gender nonconforming. And there were no laws back then. There was no like, it was a whisper network of which foster home was going to be safe, you know? And so that was me at 15 and 16. So it's like, that doesn't just get erased when I start writing about science. Anyway. Whatever. Not trying to do a cred move. It's more
I want that 15-year-old in this room. That 15-year-old is very welcome here.
Well, it's just like you don't and with the idea that you are building a world that can be easier for the 15-year-olds now, which matters. As a project, you know.
Sure does.
I think in the UK, it's, you know, it's a challenging moment for many feminists. And it's not, of course, only in the UK. Hi, Trump. Not that he's a feminist, but, you know, but it's not like it's isolated to that one white-ish island. Right.
No, indeed.
It's just more that that has a lot more power there. And I think it's I've made some inroads. It's not all full my job to make those inroads, but it's been more of a thing that I've had to engage with than I have here in the US for sure.
Interesting.
Well, I think Kat has a tech check, a next book, and like at least two children that she might need to attend to. So I think we have to let the scholar go for now. But the book is Eve, How the Female Body Drove 200 Million Years of Human Evolution by Kat Bohannon. It was such a pleasure. We will hope to see you another time, another way soon.
Thank you for being on The Feminist Present. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
The Feminist Present is a production of the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research. The co-hosts are Adrian Daub and Laura Good. This podcast is produced by Ana de Almeida Almiral. We are especially grateful to our feminist colleagues, Allison Bell Crossley, Jennifer Portillo, Cynthia Newberry, Leah Gottlieb, Bethany J. Nichols, Jessica Lopez, Susan Krieger, Argavon Salas, and Moira Donegan.